Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again, and welcome to As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans in Washington. Today on the program, you will hear about how colleges in the United States are ranked. But first, Mario Ritter reports on the recent shutdown of a church by the Chinese government.
The Chinese government has ordered a church closed. Chinese police raided Huoshi Church. The church is the largest unregistered church in Guiyang, Guizhou province. After the raid, the church officially closed, lead pastor Su Tianfu said. Su said the congregation is very upset. The pastor added that the church assists in charitable work and helps orphans, the sick, and the elderly. The latest crackdown started when police raided morning services. Church members said that police searched the church and took audio and video equipment. One pastor was arrested after he refused to let police walk away with video camera recordings. Recent crackdowns on religion have made house churches popular in China. It is estimated millions of Chinese are members of underground churches. Estimates of the size of China's Christian population place their numbers at nearly 88 million people. Members of the Huoshi Church think popularity doomed their parish. 6 years ago, just a few people worshipped there. The membership increased to more than 700. Freedom of religion is part of China's constitution. But human rights activists say the Chinese Communist Party has a poor record of preserving religious freedom. I'm Mario Ritter.
You are listening to As It Is from VOA Learning English. Lists that rank the quality of colleges are everywhere. They rank schools for everything from best academics to best food. But rankings are not as simple as they may seem. Jill Robbins and John Russell have the report.
Students in the United States usually start their college search by looking at rankings. Which are the best academically? Which has the most affordable tuition? It can be a difficult decision. The U.S. has many public, private, and even online schools. Students can choose from two-year colleges, four-year colleges, and trade schools. There are over 1,700 two-year colleges, 2,900 four-year colleges, and 4,700 schools giving degrees. Choosing the right college is very important to students and their families. They look to rankings, or lists of schools, to make that choice. But rankings are not as simple as they seem.
U.S. News and World Report uses information from more than 1,000 schools to create a list of the top universities. The Princeton Review and Forbes are also well-known lists that rank schools. U.S. News and World Report measures selectivity. Selectivity means that the school accepts a small percent of applicants. Schools can pick and choose from their applicants. The applicants must have excellent academic records and very high test scores. The college rankings are determined by several factors. How well teachers are paid is one. The rate of graduation is important, too. The problem says Jonathan Rothwell, an expert at Brookings, is that schools that are selective may benefit from better students. It does not mean that they provide the best education. Others have released rankings that measure how much money students make after graduating. For example, The Economist released college rankings in October. Because employment after graduation is uncertain, some students want to learn if their school will give them skills to find a high-paying career. Stacy Bergdale and Alan B. Krug are Harvard researchers. They looked at two groups of students with similar test scores. One group could have gone to selective schools, but they chose to attend schools that were less selective. That group of students still made the same amount of money as the students who went to selective schools. This suggests that it is the student, not the school, that creates the success. Jonathan Rothwell says that we do not need more ranking systems. He says we need better ones. He, too, has created a ranking system. It is called the value-added approach. His approach shows the contribution of college education to student salaries.
The growing number of college ranking systems suggests that students and parents demand better information about colleges. As the cost of higher education becomes too much for many students, policymakers have to deal with how to control those costs. The U.S. Department of Education says that in 2012 through 2013, the average cost of an education at a four-year private college was $35,074 per year. Four-year public colleges cost $17,474 on average. In 1982 through 1983, the average cost of an education at a four-year private college was $16,797. Four-year public colleges cost $7,534 on average. These numbers are adjusted for inflation. Developing a new, effective college ranking system was one of the Obama administration's important strategies for improving higher education. In 2013, the Department of Education announced a new plan for ranking colleges. It looks at the annual cost after financial aid, the school's graduation rate, and the annual salary for graduates. President Obama announced the plan.
Our first priority is aimed at providing better value for students, making sure that families and taxpayers are getting what we pay for. Today, I'm directing Arne Duncan, our Secretary of Education, to lead an effort to develop a new rating system for America's colleges before the 2015 college year. I think we should rate colleges based on opportunity. Are they helping students from all kinds of backgrounds succeed? And on outcomes, on their value to students and parents.
The Obama administration's goal is to give students information to help them choose the school that is right for them and avoid unnecessary loans, too. The Obama administration has not released college rankings. However, in September, the U.S. Department of Education released the College Scorecard, which has information about many colleges in the U.S. It offers information about programs, schools, and costs. The new College Scorecard does not rank schools. Jonathan Rothwell says that the College Scorecard has weaknesses. It is based on students who took out loans or received money from the U.S. government. The scorecard also calculates students' salaries for 10 years after graduation. That may or may not be enough time to show the value of a college degree. I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm John Russell.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow for another As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans. Thanks for listening.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Another new study finds that drinking coffee can help you live longer. Researchers at the Harvard School of Public Health recently discovered that drinking between 3 and 5 cups of coffee a day may prevent certain illnesses. They found that coffee can protect against heart disease, brain diseases, type 2 diabetes, and suicide. Walter Willett is a nutrition researcher at Harvard and co-author of the study. Willett says the findings extend to both caffeinated and decaffeinated coffee. The large study of about 200,000 subjects included data from 3 ongoing studies. Subjects in the study had to answer questions about their coffee drinking habits every 4 years over a 30-year period. Researchers found that moderate coffee drinking was linked with a reduced risk of death from many diseases. These diseases include cardiovascular disease, diabetes, neurological diseases such as Parkinson's, and suicide. However, the researchers found no link between coffee drinking and cancer. Researchers also considered other habits such as smoking, obesity, and how active the subjects were. They also looked at what kinds of foods the subjects ate, as well as how much alcohol and what type of alcohol they drank. They published their findings in the journal Circulation. This Harvard research adds to a growing body of evidence. This body of evidence finds that drinking a moderate amount of coffee may have many health benefits, including a longer life. This is according to one of the researchers involved in the study. Frank Hu is senior author of the study. He is also a professor of nutrition and epidemiology. He studies how food affects illness. Hu adds that data from the study support the 2015 Dietary Guidelines Advisory Report. This report found that drinking a moderate amount of coffee can be part of a healthy diet. But how much and when you drink coffee is important. Not everyone feels the recent Harvard study confirms anything. The news organization, NPR, spoke with one expert, who warns that not everyone reacts to coffee the same way. Andrew Maynard of Arizona State University told NPR that the health benefits documented in this new study are small. Maynard says the study does not prove cause and effect between drinking coffee and living longer. He says the study points to an association or link between drinking coffee and living longer. Even those involved in the research still have questions. When NPR spoke with study co-author Walter Willett, he said he is not sure how coffee is linked to certain health benefits. Willett says the important thing to learn is that if you like coffee, do not feel guilty about drinking it in moderation. If you don't like coffee, don't feel you have to start drinking it to be healthy. I'm Anna Mateo.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In 1880, President Rutherford Hayes completed 4 successful years in the White House. He did not want to serve another term. Hayes was a Republican. His party had great hopes of electing another Republican in the election of 1880. This week in our series, Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe report on that election.
Many Republicans wanted to nominate former President Ulysses Grant. Grant had been out of office 4 years. People seemed to have forgotten the political problems that shook his administration. Other Republicans supported the powerful party leader, Senator James Blaine. A third candidate was John Sherman, the Secretary of the Treasury. The Republicans had great difficulty choosing among Grant, Blaine, and Sherman. At their national convention, Republican delegates voted again and again. None of the 3 men received a majority.
The delegates voted 10 times, 20 times, 30 times. Finally, on the 34th ballot, 17 of the delegates voted for a compromise candidate. He was James Garfield, a Republican leader in Congress. Soon, both Sherman and Blaine asked all of their delegates to vote for Garfield. The compromise candidate won the nomination. James Garfield offered the vice presidential nomination to Chester Arthur of New York. Arthur's honesty had been questioned when President Hayes removed him as collector of taxes for the port of New York. But a powerful party leader there supported him. So delegates gave Arthur the vice presidential nomination to strengthen party unity.
The Democratic Party chose for its presidential candidate a hero of the Civil War, General Winfield Scott Hancock of Pennsylvania. The election campaign of 1880 was not exciting. Democrats charged that Republicans were dishonest. Republicans charged that a Democrat in the White House would make the South too powerful. Many people at that time still hated the South for starting the Civil War. They wanted to keep Southern states weak. 9 million people voted in the election. James Garfield won. He got only 10,000 more popular votes than Winfield Scott Hancock, but he got a majority of votes in the Electoral College. Garfield won 214 electoral votes. Hancock got 155.
The new president was 49 years old. He had served in the House of Representatives for 17 years. He had been a teacher, a college president, and a general in the Union Army during the Civil War. James Garfield became president of the United States on March 4th, 1881. His choices for a cabinet immediately reopened the conflicts that had appeared during the party convention.
The Republican Party had two powerful leaders. One was Senator Roscoe Conkling. The other was Senator James Blaine. Garfield won Blaine's support by naming him Secretary of State. He lost Conkling's support by refusing to name one of Conkling's supporters Secretary of the Treasury. Garfield denied he had promised anything to Conkling. Then he made Conkling even angrier by appointing one of Conkling's political enemies collector of taxes for the Port of New York. That was the most important federal job in Conkling's home state. Conkling refused to accept the appointment. He began a struggle in the Senate to block it.
Conkling charged that President Garfield had failed to observe the policy of senatorial courtesy. Traditionally, the president does not fill federal jobs in a state until he discusses them with the senators from that state. This long-time policy gave senators firm control over local federal jobs. They were quick to attack any changes in the method. But many senators were angry at Conkling. They did not like the way he gave orders to everyone. They did not like the way he threatened his opponents. They did not want to support him on this issue.
After several weeks, it became clear that the Senate would approve President Garfield's choice for the tax collector's job. Conkling decided to resign in protest. He would ask the New York legislature to show its support by electing him again to the Senate. Before this could happen, something very unexpected took place. It happened in the train station in Washington, D.C. on July 2, 1881. A man ran up to President Garfield, pulled out a gun, and fired twice. One bullet cut Garfield's arm. The other went into his back.
The assassin was Charles Guiteau. When he fired the gun, he shouted that he supported Roscoe Conkling's political machine. Charles Guiteau was insane. He believed God had ordered him to kill the president. But the words he shouted caused many people to wonder if others might be involved. After all, the vice president, Chester Arthur, supported Roscoe Conkling too. If James Garfield died, Chester Arthur would become president. History has provided no evidence that Roscoe Conkling, Chester Arthur, or any other political leader had a part in the shooting. Guiteau is believed to have acted on his own. Yet the situation did cause a great deal of tension while the nation waited to see if Garfield would survive.
The president was carried to the White House. A doctor tried to remove the bullet from his back. He could not find it. Days passed. The president's condition changed from day to day. Doctors pushed their instruments into the wound as they continued to look for the bullet. The wound became infected. Garfield grew worse. Then he grew better. He asked to be taken to the seashore. 2 months later, the doctors warned the cabinet and Vice President Arthur that Garfield was dying. The end finally came on September 19th, 1881. The president's body was taken back to Washington. Memorial services were held there. And then the body was taken to his home state of Ohio for burial.
Not until after Garfield's death did doctors find the bullet that killed him. It lay only a few centimeters from the wound. Tissue had grown around it. The bullet itself would not have killed the president. What killed him was the effort made by doctors to find the bullet. Their instruments had spread infection throughout his body. James Garfield had been president for 6 months. He was the second American president to be assassinated. The first, Abraham Lincoln, had been shot just 16 years before.
The man who shot James Garfield, Charles Guiteau, was tried by a court in Washington. He was found guilty of murder. Like those found guilty of plotting to kill Abraham Lincoln, he was hanged. Vice President Chester Arthur was in New York when he received news of President Garfield's death. He quickly sent for a judge to give him the oath of office as president. Arthur was in his early 50s. He would serve one term as leader of the United States. That will be our story next week.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe. Transcripts, MP3s, and podcasts of our programs are online, along with historical images, at voaspecialenglish.com. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.